this inner consciousness, then the body is no longer a problem to us. It is an instrument. It is a useful and proper servant of our great purpose. And it is just as important that consciousness be revealed through body as through thought or deed. And it is revealed through body in the terms of the absolute harmony and integration of body. The body becomes ensouled by a universal power. And that in this way it becomes capable of being immediately available to the will, to the consciousness, to the mind and the emotions for the fulfillment of their own numerous activities. Now there is another question that arises in this matter, and that is the sublimation of body. In the great processes of evolution, as taught in Eastern thinking, there are two schools. One is that man is going to gradually escape from body. The body is going to be tossed aside like an old garment along the road somewhere. Perhaps this is one of the reasons for a peculiar symbolism that we find in the teachings of Buddha. Because when the time came for the young prince to go forth and take up the work as a mendicant, he is said, at least in one legend, to have taken off his princely raiment and his jewels, and to have cut his hair, and the little angels carried the hair away in space, and all these kinds of things. And then he looked for an appropriate garment with which to cover his body, and which would later become the symbol of his order. Found that which was peculiarly suitable to his need, a shroud that had been cast aside beside the grave of the dead. This shroud became the symbol of the Brotherhood of the Yellow Robe, the saffron-colored garment of the Buddhist monk. There's a symbolism here, perhaps, namely, that the body itself has a kind of holiness in it that we have been more or less taught to disregard. We have been taught to kind of look upon the body as the burden of the spirit and let it rest that way. Actually, there is much to suggest that the use of the body by the consciousness in it is gradually accomplishing the transformation of the body itself. And that the time will almost certainly come when the invisible psychic vehicles of man will absorb the body. That instead of casting it off and forgetting it, the illusion will probably ultimately result in the body gradually rising in its vibratory rate until it is returned again into consciousness. That it will not be cast off, but that it will be reabsorbed into the higher energies of man. And that the fact that man lives in the body is the way in which he is contributing to the growth of the millions of forms of life that make up the body. Because our bodies are composed of countless living organisms, hundreds of millions, billions of organisms that are eternal living things within us. To these creatures, which may or may not have existence in a certain sense, this self in us, this egoism, this conscious polarization within ourselves, is a kind of deity upon which all these cells depend for their lives. And upon the wisdom of which the whole economy of the body with its vast population depends. Thus man as the God must ultimately accept in himself the consciousness of his own parts, just as man must experience ultimately with others of his kind the consciousness of his own causing power, or that which is the creative power behind him. So as man hopes to be united with the universal, it is very well probable that the separate cells in man have as their destiny to be reunited with that universal which is their superior, in this case the consciousness of man himself. We mustn't regard the body as an evil, something to be borne as a burden, something that is a symbol of our sin and fall, but rather we should regard it as our universe, and that in the administration of it we are beginning in a simple way the experience of our own Godhood. For just as we live and move and have our being within a universal consciousness, So these little lives have their life and movement, have their being within us. And in some way, our consciousness is diffused to become theirs. And the restoration of their consciousness into unity is the restoration of our own. Thus, in the process of integration of consciousness, man draws all these innumerable little life units gradually back to form the over-unit of himself. They return to him as we hope to return to God. And through this experience, we are fulfilling a responsibility to body. For body is our world. Body is our universe in which we are experimenting with the tremendous creative powers of nature. We are not aware of this as yet, but there is much to cause us to assume that it could very well be the truth. And that therefore, we are here to redeem my body, not to destroy it. We are here to bring about its resurrection within us to these spiritual ends and purposes for which it was intended and originally fashioned. Now, Hatha Yoga gives us something else to think about, because not only do we have the body to consider, but we have the effect of body upon mind and emotion. Man has recognized the need for thoughtfulness. We all need it. We practice too little of it. And as a result of thoughtlessness, we get into innumerable complicated situations that deplete and depress all the resources which would normally be available to us. Thus, we block our own energy supply by circumstances which we have permitted to occur, which should never have occurred, and would never have occurred had we been thoughtful. Now, the average person has got to learn to be thoughtful. He's had too much experience in being thoughtless. He has too many bad habits to break down. So he can become thoughtful in various ways by the disciplines which he imposes upon his own life, symbolically, visibly. Have you ever thought, for example, what it would mean to sit down and keep quiet for 5 minutes? Everyone said, oh yes, I can do that easily enough. So try it. You'll be lucky if you last 5 seconds. You will find that the moment you relax, the moment a dynamic objective no longer presses you away from yourself, and you begin to fall back into yourself, that you're in trouble. You will find that in the moment the controlling purpose is not there to help, innumerable small secondary purposes begin to objectify. A friend of mine who tried very hard to concentrate over a number of years and never was able to get anything out of it except a headache told me on one occasion that the moment he tried to sit quiet and concentrate, something itched. And sometimes it's one of those side approaches that is so deep you can't even scratch it. But this problem is that the moment we relax our control, there's a tendency of everything to go to pieces. Nothing seems to be able to run on itself. And the moment we try to release our consciousness for any subtler and deeper purpose, something itches. There is no cooperation, no basic cooperation. And unless the body is brought under discipline, symbolically at least, the individual cannot depend upon it remaining quiet when he wants it to. And if the body does not remain to a certain degree quiet under certain conditions, there is practically no possibility of an over life for that person. He can never get far enough from the storm of the fury to achieve anything as an internal being. The body is forever nagging him, forever disrupting him, forever reminding him of itself. So he has to learn to struggle with that situation and overcome it. And one of the problems in yoga is to achieve internal freedom from body, in the sense that the individual can sit down quietly and have an inner life when and where he wants it, as he needs it, as he demands it, without this endless interruption on one level or another. If the body doesn't interrupt, the emotions are very active. And if the emotions will not, then the thoughts will. But the individual seeking to establish a situation of receptivity within himself is always bothered by himself. There is something that never lets go, something that never permits him simply to make the adventure of identification with reality. The illusions are always working. They never rest. It's like the sound of a great city. There is never any silence. And in this compound of man, there is never any silence unless this silence is the result of a scientific solution to the problem of the sound. It will never happen by accident. The individual will never wake up some morning and find that he can do these things unless he has tried and labored and learned and disciplined. Now, the purpose of yoga, basic purpose of yoga, is a reversal of the object-subject relationships which we know in life. In the West, man is to possess truth. He is going to conquer it. In the East, he is going to be possessed by it. In the West, he is going to know. In the East, he is going to be known. The consciousness of the Western man is attempting to solve the mystery of reality. Whereas in the East, it would be better to say that reality is seeking in some way to reaffirm that it already knows the mystery of man. It is that the universal will return to its own universality, and in so doing, that the individual receives into and passes through himself a tremendous universal quotient. He is not going to achieve a personal illumination. He is going to experience a universal illumination that is forever present. There is an Indian story which I rather like the thought of, namely that Buddha, sitting under the tree, received the illumination. And we would say, and as the story says, the heavens opened and the arhats and the Buddhas were gone before, and all the great hierarchs appeared and descended and surrounded him. But in some of the schools, such as the Zen view, there's a little different approach to this. They say that the illumination, which we associate with the enlightenment of the Buddha, that the illumination was always there, just like it was the day it came to him. And what we call illumination is man's experiencing that which is always there. It didn't happen in the sense that it occurred at that moment. It is forever occurring. But that was the moment in which the man tuned into it. So that universality, absolute consciousness, is forever present. It is not something that man is creating. It is not something that man is building. It's not something that is a chemical byproduct of his own thinking and emotions. Truth, reality, actuality, being, this tremendous overtone concept is always here. It is here right now. It has always been here. It was here before any creature experienced it. And it will be here after the last creature does experience it. The moments of the enlightenment that come to individuals are the eternal in their relation, in its relation to the individual, not to itself. It is all. So this terrific crash of the cosmos is taking place eternally. But the individual, under certain experiences, becomes susceptible to it, becomes capable of at least a momentary experience of it through himself. But when it fades out, it doesn't mean it's faded out and faded out in the sky like a dying star. It means that the adjustment between that which is unchangeable and man has been broken. So that as far as man is concerned, it seems to fade out, but the thing itself never fades, never increases, never decreases. It is the relationship of the person and his ability to carry the experience that determines the duration of it. So the individual as a person is a comparative unit of ignorance floating in a sea of wisdom. The individual is a little spot of darkness in an ocean of light, or a little spot of self-light in an ocean of universal darkness. And he is the little drop that is seeking to return to the sea. And in this tremendous concept, the reason why this experience always seems so distant, so remote, so unattainable, so inconceivable, is that man cannot get into the condition of his own inner whereby he can experience it. Sometimes he gets quite close and has an intuitive a perception of something. He feels something happening, and then this spell is broken and he's back where he was before. Or in a great mysticism or in ecstasy or in samadhi, he may have a momentary flash of something. He may touch the radiant fringe of this dark robe of the unknown. But he cannot hold it. And he drops back again into his own objectivity. And constantly, he is seeking for this restatement, this re-at-one-ment with a universal reason. The yogas have as their primary objective to gradually remove the obstacles to this universal. Actually, growth is not the increase of virtue, but the removal of obstacles. It is not that something is growing better because good is forever, but that interferences are being gradually removed. So that growth is not really the positive thing it seems to be. It is the recovery from negatives. It is the elimination of that which is not so. Man, when he says, I am searching for truth, what he is really telling us is that he is trying to recover from error. He's trying to get rid of the mistake. He's trying to get the straight line again as against the crooked path on which he has found himself. To do this, the Indian, the East Indian, has a concept of evolution that is rather different from ours, and been a cause of considerable discussion and anxiety among various schools of thinkers. Evolution in the West means the gradual growth of things. Growth in the East means the gradual restatement of the reality of things. Actually, evolution has reality because either things must grow gradually through the release from error, through experience, which is the basis of growth. The individual, age after age, restating, reaffirming his own mistakes, suffering from them, comes finally to giving them up one by one. And as he does so, he is said to grow because he's getting over his own mistakes. Now, this is evolution. Now, it can take a very long time, or it can take a shorter time, depending upon the integrity and the energy that is directed toward this particular end. Now, as the Taoists in China will tell you, that the supreme action of the will is that action which annihilates the will. That the supreme end of all of these processes of growing is that which transcends growth itself, with the recognition that the ultimate is already here and has always been here. Therefore, that growth is bridging an interval from error to reality. And that this can be bridged either by fighting toward reality or by the sudden and dynamic relaxation of error. A terrific relaxation of error. And this is the process of being still. The dropping away of the entire concept of error. This, of course, sounds like a quick way to do it. But don't get too excited. Because what it takes to get the consciousness into the condition that it will let go of error It is not another simple matter. But theoretically, the individual could achieve the samadhi or the nirvana, or even the paranirvana, not instantly, theoretically. Factually, he's not going to make it. Because he cannot blast this personality atom of his own consciousness. But actually, he can achieve a transcendence over the illusion of the evolutionary process by the tremendous achievement of that which is the natural end of evolution, the breaking up of the error pattern, the breaking up of the fixation of the mind, by means of which things have appearances but not reality. Nothing is either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so, is an old Eastern axiom. So if thinking makes things good and bad, to stop thinking means that they are no longer good or bad. And in that, they are real. Because both good and bad are dreams. But the suspension of the power to formulate the concepts of good and bad results from discipline, results from the gradual direction of consciousness. Now, the Western psychologist is of the opinion that this Eastern method is to drop the individual back into a negation. That what the Easterner is trying to tell us, according to the Western psychologist, is that the individual should renounce everything that he has achieved from the beginning of time. That the individual is to admit, frankly, that his own existence is a mistake. And that his entire civilization, world, and culture, all of these things are delusions. And that the only solution to himself is the complete removal of himself. That is a Western conclusion drawn by a broad stroke by an individual who didn't know anything about it. Because that is not actually what is implied or intended. It may seem to be so, but it is not actually so. The thing that lies underneath this project is that man is faced with a dilemma. He's going to have to face it sometime. And that dilemma is that the fragment can never, of itself, possess totality. The individual, like a fish in an ocean, will never be able to drink the whole ocean. And yet, the individual's desire to know, the impulse to know, is endless, beyond any conscious control by himself. The desire to grow is innate in man. The desire to find reality, as Lua demands at the beginning of time. But he has worked upon the basis of contemplation, namely that he can sit somewhere or stand somewhere and look out and see reality. That he's going to be able to sit down and listen while someone tells him the truth. Or that he's going to be able to look out and see the truth and say, well, now that's the truth and that isn't. He is always assuming that as a separate contemplating entity, that he is going to be the spectator to the revelation of universal reality. It's going to happen and he's going to see it happen. And from that time on, he's going to know what it is. So when Pilate asked Jesus the question, what is truth, the master was silent. He didn't answer. And theoretically, he was the only one that could have. But he didn't. Because the concept that man is going to possess it, that he's going to be able to go walk down the street and say to a friend of his, last night I saw the truth, is an optimism. It can't happen. The reason why it can't happen is that the human being simply hasn't the faculties to know it if he saw it. And if every resource available to the park was developed, still, totality is not an integral a possibility of a park. The individual unit cannot experience totality. The only thing that it can experience totality is itself. The only thing that can ever know truth is truth. The only being that can ever experience universality is universal being, because it is the only totality. It is the only fullness of itself in which there can be no deficiency of itself. The only question naturally arises, can fragmentary consciousness, existing only in the contemplation of power, even contemplate or formulate a concept concerning the totality of an experience of any kind? If totality is experiencing itself, have we any way of even guessing what that experience may be? We cannot, for the simple reason that the complete experience of totality is its own uniqueness. Nothing but itself can answer. And totality implies something else. It implies no division. Therefore, no contrast and no conflict. We know things and estimate them only because of contrast or conflict. This is large because this is smaller. This is a peaceful state because last week that state was war, and this is the opposite. This we understand because something else we do not understand, and everything is light and shadow. In totality, there is no light and shadow. There is no contrast and no conflict. Therefore, how can we define an experience which is without boundary, without dimension, without contrast? The Westerner, trying to work with it, comes to the conclusion that it sounds to him like a great big hole in the dark. The only possible experience that universality can have of itself is a universal experience which to the Western thinker would be equivalent to no experience, complete suspension of experience. That would be true if it had to be estimated in terms of any experience that we know. And we go back to our psychological problem. We have this term, the unconscious. Well, are we to understand that as something in itself unconscious or something of which we are unconscious? Actually, we have only the assumption that we have bestowed the name unconscious upon that which transcends our concept of consciousness. Yet we have no way of knowing that the unconscious is unconscious of itself. We are unconscious of it. Now, totality as an experience of consciousness for man is therefore impossible of attainment. Man can approach it a little more directly under some conditions. But as he approaches it, as he gets even a step nearer to it, he discovers that the definitions of fragments as he has known them, these definitions lose their distinction. So we have the individual who says, if I had universal consciousness, I could play the piano. No, he couldn't. Because in universal consciousness, the piano wouldn't exist. It belongs to a part of something. It belongs to a division, but not to totality. Totality cannot bestow wisdom on itself. Because wisdom is a fragment, I guess. And wisdom cannot possess totality. So as we approach the absolute boundary of universality of consciousness, we move towards something to which we can never take a positive relationship. I remember one dear old soul I knew years ago who had a lot of trouble with the absolute. Finally, she joined a group that was really the answer. That group was the absolute absolute. that was twice as good as the absolute. Then one day she explained to me that the only reason she still existed was because she had gone into the absolute and come out through the top. Still remains a great question of how foolish we can get. But we cannot contemplate that because the very thing we contemplate with is part of it. And the contemplation of it still means two things. Someone contemplating and something to contemplate. So there has to be two. or there can be no relationship exist. But therefore, as we approach this issue, we have to be the contemplating power. And we have to contemplate what is over there. In so doing, we still are completely in a sphere of fantasy, because the only thing that we will find over there is what we are here. And instead of finding the reality, we will see only the reflection of our own little circle of consciousness in space. The contemplator can see nothing but himself. Therefore, to him, the universe is someone contemplating back at him. And he doesn't know that it's himself. Therefore, he can begin the very delicate process. By drawing up on fantasy and imagination, he can begin to create things out there. And his imagination and his fantasy will populate that space out there with the most intricate tapestry of deities and powers. The more he thinks about them, the more he looks at them, the clearer they'll get. But they'll all be himself. He invented them, he devised them, he put them there. And he will continue to put something over here that is in here, as long as he is related to this and that by an interval. He cannot experience. He can only create there. So whatever he creates within his own consciousness as his concept of reality will be reality. But the fact he will never know. He will always be seeing only the products of the illusional focus of his own individual contemplative nature. So he cannot get there. The self cannot get there, and it never will. The only thing he can do is to gradually pass from the consideration of lesser things to the consideration of greater things. He can pass from the hypnosis of materiality to the hypnosis of theology. On the material plane, he was serving false gods. He could do the same thing on the theological. But as long as he is a contemplating unit, examining and estimating something separate from himself, whether he see that separateness inside or outside of his own body is not important. As long as he conceives it as something that can be contemplated, the interval remains. And he cannot cross that in because he cannot challenge or assail or attack that infinite that is there. What then is the only possibility that he can achieve? He has to move from a contemplative footing to what may be termed a meditational footing. He has to move from an effort to know to the condition of a capacity to receive. Totality can reach him, but he cannot reach it. Totality has always been within his grasp, but you know it. He can receive it, but he cannot demand it. He cannot visualize it, he cannot explore it, but it can visualize him and explore him. So that in your Eastern concept, the bridge across this interval is to pass from the state of the observer to the state of the participator. In other words, instead of seeing, instead of attempting to analyze with the best Western technique, the ability to become receptive to it, to let it move in upon you, is the important thing. Now, it cannot move in upon you if your house is already full. It cannot move in upon your selfhood and annihilate. Because the universal power, presuming it could do so, has no right to do so. That power cannot destroy you. It cannot even destroy an illusion for you, because it's the cause of all the illusions you've ever had anyway. it will not destroy this central force. It can move through you and past you, and you will never know it is there. The center of focus becomes, in a strange way, the great sacrifice. It is the eternal martyr, the scapegoat, that which must die for the sin of the world. It is the voluntary renunciation of the contemplating selfhood that makes possible the universal experience. That has to occur by the individual voluntarily moving from the condition of an observer to the condition of one experiencing a receptivity into his own nature. Thus, as the self, or the center of contemplation, relaxes, to the same degree the universal seems to move in upon the individual. And as his own definition of what it is ceases, the experience of that which it is becomes possible. As long as man says reality is square, it will always seem so to him, and he will never know what reality is. If he says it is round, he will never know what it is. If he names it, he will never find it, as Van Dyke says, but the one who finds it, it needs no name. Thus, whatever his own consciousness says of it, that definition blocks the reality. No matter how noble, how beautiful, how generous, how kind, how laudable this definition may be, it still blocks the fact. Man can say God is all, and by that he has blocked the fact. He may say God is good, but by that he has blocked the fact. Because the moment he imposes anything from himself upon that, the thatness of it is gone forever, as far as he is concerned. Consequently, in the problem, the individual is forced to face the fact that he cannot get across that interval. The only thing that he can do about it is to reduce gradually his own definition, realizing that to the degree that he can escape from what he thinks this is, to that degree he may find out what it is. All his speculations are limitations. His only hope is that this thing will experience him, and that gradually he will be capable of an identification with a state that is completely beyond personal experience. Now, what will happen to him if he finds it? Assuming for a moment that he achieves this state, what happens? If this state is achieved under discipline, temporarily, as in a samadhi or something of that nature, it is not complete. Because if it was complete and the dissolution of the ego had taken place, there would be no return from samadhi. So, even samadhi is not a full statement of this reality. But it is this statement being brought nearer and nearer to the individual through the gradual reduction of his own interpretive power. Man passes from contemplation to meditation by transforming interpretation into experience. In other words, and this is not easy to say, in case you may think we have a little word trouble. Because these things do not fit into words at all well. They fit into silence much better. But in an effort to try to convey something, we try to use words. In your state of samadhi or ecstasy or an apotheistic condition, there has been a gradual breaking down of an interpretative instinct and a gradual increase in the impact of a reality, until fragments of the reality and fragments of the interpretation mix. The interpreting becomes less, the realities become stronger, and the individual therefore moves from a condition of interpretation to an almost completely uninterpreted impact. He may have the ecstasis of a tremendous feeling, an incredible feeling of godliness, an incredible feeling of an absolute benevolence moving in upon him. In the moment of ecstasy, he got perturbed. And as long as he can refrain from interpreting it, he can hold it. But the moment he says to himself, "This is wonderful," the spell is broken. The moment he contemplates the thing that is happening to him, the contemplator emerges again, closes the door. It is only while the impact of this thing has swept him completely out of his own rational and emotional footings, so he accepts without question, like the small child accepting knowledge. In that moment, he receives a certain degree. The contemplator is overwhelmed for an instant, for a little time. And then the orientation begins again. The contemplator says, "I think I was illumined." The moment he says that, he is no longer. Because the contemplator has reestablished its individual self and closed the door. So these illuminations come in the form of a tremendous sweeping surge that cause tremendous emotional or psycho-mental reflexes, and are usually described as this tremendous and inconceivable experience of well-being, that there is this impact of absolute rightness moving in upon the individual, that everything is divinely and eternally as it should be. Then he says to himself, "How should it be?" It's gone. Or he says to himself, "This experience tells me I should no longer fear." He has begun to rationalize and experience those again. It is only in the immediate and unconditioned impact of the thing itself, with the complete transcendence of all interpretive, contemplative sense of the continuance of self in relation to this thing. For a moment, the individual, the self, is drowned in the experience. In that moment, the experience is real. But the so-called drowned self swims to shore, reestablishes its own identity, and the experience is gone. Thus, in the contemplative yogic prana, the breaking through of the pattern of expectancy, the breaking through of the traditional form, even in which illumination itself is supposed to occur, is vital. The individual expecting to see something or experience something will experience what he expects, will then think he is illumined, and will be the victim of a vicious circle. The only answer is the absolute transcendence of the impulse to expect. He must not expect he will see anything or experience anything, because whatever he expects will happen. It is the transcendency of even the expectation of the form this thing will take, which makes possible its formlessness or its absolute impact. The impact as an experience has been described by both Eastern and Western mystics. You'll find it considerably influencing certain Sufi doctrines and, of course, the Neoplatonists, especially Plotinus. And they express it symbolically, always. Namely, that the individual has the experience of his God, or experiences the fullness of a divine nature. That in these moments, all doubt, all uncertainty, all fear, all unreasonable perturbation on any subject, all ambition, desire, hope, even the religious urge itself, all these things are swept away. There is nothing but the immediate experience of a tremendous reality, an actuality, a beingness, that transforms space from a vacuum into an absolute fullness, that the individual suddenly realizes, instead of being a person in space, that the space is the reality and he is the vacuum. Complete reversal of his relationship to existence. And in that reversal, the absolute possession of his being
by this quality or condition. Now, there are several ways in which this may be interpreted therefrom. Plotinus brings out, of course, the circumstance of the individual having had this experience. Comes back into the world again. He has only a flat head. But as he says in his writings, the one instant of this, in relation to the extent of a human life, changes that entire life. But never that individual again can be captured in the net of dreams. Never can he fall again into the illusion. Because he has experienced an instant of actuality. And in that instant, every factor of existence has been reorganized. Every value has been reversed. Every concern has been completely washed of all the concern that was in it. And the individual then has experienced something that tells him that reality is greater than himself. And that the full expression of this reality is more important than the continuance of himself. And that for this, the sacrifice of self is nothing. Whereas to the average individual, the sacrifice of self would be everything. Because he has no awareness beyond it. So we don't expect that the average student is going to achieve to such a situation immediately. But all of your contemplative disciplines, especially your yogas, are moving gradually in that direction. Moving in the direction of gradually liberating the individual, not only from his objective and natural and obvious errors, but gradually eliminating from him this hyper-concept of the contemplating self that must master all mysteries, solve all things, accomplish it. He gradually relaxes, even as a disciple beginning his course of study, so that this aggressive self that is going to tell the universe what it is doing, this aggressive self that is going to paint gods in the heavens, begins early to break down, not to be eliminated, but to be modified, to be brought gradually to the point that this self can become aware of something more important than the experience of selfhood. So that from there on, growth, as it unfolds and develops and increases, is a growth toward the relaxation of these pressures, a growth towards quietude, toward the letting go of the stress and strain that rotate around this terrific concept of self. It is because man has this self that he is offended, that his pride is hurt, that he seeks to accumulate, that he will take from another for his own advantage. This self makes him an individual against the world. His own survival becomes so important that he will sacrifice everything for it. And little by little, this terrific, pressureful ego complex takes over and forces his life into one unnatural channel after another, building illusion, building deceit, building error, building false symbolism, and reducing him gradually to the level that he has to survive by multiplying his own mistakes. But if, instead of attacking all of these different things, the disciple begins by slowly relaxing that central core, gradually realizing that truth is more important than self, that the direction of attention away from the person to the impersonal, service is one of the simplest forms of it. We forget ourselves helping another. And in that instant of self-forgetfulness, we achieve a happiness we never otherwise can attain. We are happier, better, more useful to the degree that we are not self-centered. And this goes on under discipline to a very advanced degree, in which finally man's supreme happiness, which is absolute identification with the eternal, is a result of a complete detachment from self-centeredness. And that is the work of the yogas. And the work of the lower yogas, what I would consider one of the lower yogas, Kali yogas, is this gradual disciplining of the individual. The relaxation of the body, the removal of the focal point of self from the physical body, from the vital body, from the various physical and psychical activities of the personality. The individual who is not thinking about himself will be happier and healthier. The moment he gets his mind off of his body, his digestion will be better. The moment he gets his mind off of his ego, his nerves, his thoughts, and his emotions will be better. It is all this, terrific fixation of self that prevents the function of everything. And if he relaxes this pressure, vitality will move through him and keep his body going. In the final relaxation of self, universal vitality, which is reality, will sweep through all of him and achieve its perfect work in him. But until he is able to break the tension caused by the self-complex, he will be physically sick, emotionally frustrated, mentally exhausted, and spiritually isolated. He must achieve gradually the breaking down of the delusion. And as he advances in the yogas, he learns more and more of this procedure, until finally, in the prince of all the yogas, he is given that which was esoterically known in India concerning this subject. But I think that our purpose tonight has been to show the importance of the discipline by means of which self-centeredness, having been released and relaxed, the body is happier, healthier. But this is a symbol of the final achievement of consciousness toward which all human beings are striving. Oh, my time's up.